What's going on, guys? Welcome to another episode of Healthspan Academy. I'm your host, Craig Shearhart, and joining me today is my special guest, Dr. Stephen Poulter. Stephen is a licensed clinical family psychologist in Los Angeles, and he's been practicing in mental health as a mental health professional in the last 35 years. He's been the author of several books, The Art of Successful Failure, Father Your Son, The Father Factor, Your Mother Factor, The X Factor, and Shame Factor. So we're going to talk today a lot about emotional management and relationships and basically how to optimize your sort of mental health, some of the tools we can use and some of the tools that are used commonly in therapy. Stephen, thanks so much for joining me today, man.
Craig, it's an honor to be here. And anything we can do to help guys and women work with the emotional side that sometimes is very hard to interpret or understand.
Absolutely. I feel like everyone in the world can relate to this problem just on some level. So let's talk about how this all began for it. Did you always want to get into mental health, or how did you kind of stumble into this field?
You know, in my former life, I was a police officer.
Oh, wow.
And I did that through my mid-20s, like 23 to 31.
Okay.
In my 30s. And I always wanted to work with people. And I thought, this would be a great way to learn about people. And I learned a lot more than I ever expected.
That's amazing.
Learned a lot more. Yeah, learned a lot more. And I found there was always this crisis, but after we left, who's really going to clean it up?
Right.
Who's really going to clean up the mess?
Yeah.
And that's kind of just, Craig, throughout my life, I always wanted to work with people.
Right.
That's always kind of been mine. And
okay.
I went to seminary, but I thought I wanted more of a wider range. And that's how I kind of ended up in psychology.
Cool. That's awesome. So and obviously clinical experience kind of led to some books. So we're going to talk a little bit about Shame Factor. I read through that, which is a very cool read. I don't feel like I actively deal with shame. I still identified with a lot of it, and it's still really helpful. A lot of the tools you talk about is mm-hmm. awesome. And the first thing that stood out is just the definition, because it's kind of one of those weird emotions. Like, how do you even define shame? You have a very specific kind of unique definition. How do you describe shame as your definition?
You know, Craig, I'm just going to read it.
And
then,
sure.
Because it's shame factor. You know, it's a primary emotional load, not a secondary. It's a belief based on a particular action. It tends to be a paralyzing emotion, mental, psychological state of mind that distorts our view of ourselves and our world with others, and ultimately prevents us from developing loving sense of ourselves and secure relationships.
Right.
And one of them is the fear of being discovered. That's when the emotions, the impending doom, something bad's going to happen. Not right. Anxiety, which is more situational.
Right.
Shame, the best knowledge I heard, shame is like looking at ivory, or, you know, there's grains in the ivory that you can't get out. You can wash the mud off, which might be anxiety or depression, but this is inside.
Right.
Ivory.
Deeply, deeply internalized.
Yeah. Deeply rooted. Yeah.
Right. So you kind of alluded to the sort of worst case scenario. If this doesn't get dealt with, that it just sort of manifests itself. So as a worst case scenario, you feel shame. And if we don't manage it properly, what is like the worst case scenario? How do things sort of snowball in your mental health spectrum?
I equate shame with emotional cancer. As we know, great. You know, cancer, if you don't address it, it keeps growing.
Right.
Because it's rebellion against the body. Or shame is rebellion against your best self.
Right.
A loving self. So over time, if you don't address it, that sense of hatred, self-loathing, a sense of feeling like a failure, will just continue to grow and make your life very small.
Right. And that just sounds a lot like depression, and almost like leading into suicidal thoughts, because it's kind of a worst case scenario, which is like, so obviously it's important. So the first step, I think it's one of those things that if it is deeply rooted, it's hard to even recognize. So, and you have some self-assessment tools in there on how to even know if you are feeling shame. So how does that process work? How does one know if they are feeling shame?
You know, it's interesting, Craig, what you said. A lot of people say, well, I don't really feel I have much shame. Shame is very, insidious. I mean, it's not right on the surface.
Right.
You know, shame is on, I use it from a scale of 0 to 10. You know, from 0 to 2, it doesn't impair your life. You can feel bad sometimes, but shame is not guilt. I want to differentiate. Guilt's related to a specific action, where shame is related to a state of mind.
Right.
a state of being.
Right.
And that's where the departure is.
Fair enough. And so you, once you've discovered that you've got this, if say, suppose that, you know, one-on-one therapy is an option, how do you start to work through that in yourself? How do, is there a certain strategy you can use to change your self-talk and sort of getting yourself unstuck?
Yeah. And I think, you know, recognizing the cycle, and I talk about seven emotional triggers. I'm just going to pull them up.
Sure.
Great. Where one of the most common is the imposter syndrome.
Right.
I'm going to be discovered that I'm not good enough in my job.
Yeah.
Of all the seven elements, I probably hear that one the most.
Huh.
You know, and I see articles in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, talking about the imposter syndrome. Mm-hmm. Imposter comes from, I don't feel good enough.
Right.
Deep down, you know, if I get a job promotion or move up, they're going to discover I'm not capable.
Right. Someone's going to find out that I'm a fraud and an imposter. Yeah.
Right. It's, and yeah, that is shame because it says mm-hmm. you're defective.
Right.
Now, it has nothing to do with your ability to perform. It's mm-hmm. this belief, Craig. And I think one of the keys is like the inner narrative. I tell people, what's the script you're telling yourself?
Right.
And the script can go back to when you're young. We're not parent blaming, but just like, when was your first time you felt embarrassed? Always start people there. And how did you manage it? What did you think? And people go, well, you know, in front of the classroom, like I was really embarrassed and didn't feel like I could talk and do it, whatever. And so that fear sometimes evolves into one of my the fear of embarrassment.
Right. So embarrassment is like the event, right? That sort of initiated the whole process.
Yeah. It's like the first domino.
Right.
And another one is people say, I feel disrespected or I feel invisible. And that goes back to not feeling noticed.
Right.
And when you feel noticed, you're not angry.
Right.
Huh. I find a lot of the teenagers I work with, they're rage, no one sees them.
Right. Huh.
They're seen, but not seen.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The third one I put the imposter syndrome, and that's feeling like you're a fraud. Mm-hmm. Like you're copying someone's homework metaphorically.
Right.
You're going to be outed. The next one is feeling isolated, and that's the fear of rejection. If people get to know me, they're not going to like me. I see this in couples a lot, where they have this distance in these problems because honestly, he or she doesn't really let you into the inner court. Because if mm-hmm. you see it all, you might leave me.
Right.
And that's a shame factor, not feeling good enough.
These are just all different layers of insecurity, more or less, right?
Or different triggers.
Right.
Yeah. Different triggers. Because deep down, again, Greg, if you ask me in one sentence, shame is the ongoing sense of not feeling good enough.
Right.
Ongoing.
Kind of like the opposite of confidence, if you're on, if.
Correct.
Right.
You know, I use the word confidence versus inferiority.
Right.
Confidence creates you're going to land on your feet and figure it out.
Right.
Inferior means I can't do it. Mm-hmm. I'm not capable. And that's kind of like the spectrum that we go on.
So the last kind of piece, did you have more to add to that?
Yeah, I got two more. The fear of intimacy. Fear of intimacy is that I'm damaged goods.
Right.
If they see me, a lot of times people go through divorces or go through a divorce, they feel, oh my God, I feel damaged. This person left me. But that wasn't the reason why the relationship ended.
Right.
But they get stuck on that one. And lastly, is the fear of criticism. Mm-hmm. If you're upset with me, I'm bad.
Right.
Those are all.
Yeah, I love that. So, and I think my mind goes straight to the fixed mindset versus growth mindset when you start talking about criticism.
Yeah.
So that, and the last thing I wanted to ask you about was like preventative measures. And is that, I feel like mindset's kind of like almost like a buzz term, but do you see that as sort of the long-term solution is flipping your script so that, you know, you're in that growth mindset. So there mm-hmm. are no failures. It's just learning experiences. And sort of you interpret everything as constructive and growing instead of like shaming kind of events.
Yes.
Is that like the ultimate sort of preventative measure?
Yeah, because ultimately it comes back to self-acceptance, what you just said.
Yeah.
And there are no mistakes. There's experiences and lessons to glean.
Right.
And shame is wraps that gift up. Many times we'll never open it. And that gift is you on the inside.
Yeah. You know? I love that. Very cool.
You're the gift on the inside, and shame gets wrapped around it like you can't get to it. You can.
Yeah, it's just this roadblock that just insurmountable right. in your way. Yeah.
And when you confront it, it does dissipate. That's the paradox.
Right. I love that. Very cool.
Yeah.
So shame, obviously, one of those deep, deep levels. I think like we're all dealing with some level of shame, probably. One of the more common things, especially since the pandemic hit, I think is just stress management. And everyone I feel like is on a little bit higher baseline, depending where you're living and what your how your government's right. handled the pandemic.
That's a good, that's a good point.
Yeah. But in my own personal experience, stress is one of those things that just creeps up on me. It's just like, you almost don't notice it until it's like too late. And then it's like, and then you start to feel it physically. When you feel it physically, I feel like that's almost, it just hasn't been dealt with. So the first step, obviously, is a warning sign. So what are the warning signs you tell people to look out for when we talk about stress management?
You know, I call them pre-incident indicators. Okay, like if we feel our body is spilling over.
Right.
And many times, you know, stress, you know, one man's stress is another man's blessing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I tell people with stress, what is it that you fear? What is it you fear? Talk yourself through that, then you can talk yourself back.
Right.
You know, that's really, you know, like during the pandemic, many people were worried they're going to lose their jobs or different things are going to happen. Okay, so what happens if that happens? And after a while, you kind of talk it through. It's a lot of it's smoke and mirrors.
Right.
Because stress keeps you on the surface, Greg, versus doing a deep dive. What's down there? Well, you know, maybe something in my past happened. Maybe my parents. My dad lost his job and we got divorced, things like that.
Right. Fair enough. And then essentially we have these, like, you got to kind of have to disrupt the patterns. So you identify the issue. What I'm hearing from you is it's basically, you kind of have to respond to this emotion with some kind of logical thought or logical train of like, well, let's find out the root issue. So, and that's obviously easier for some people than others, right? You can kind of switch from like this emotional response to, so what, how do you talk people through that when it's not that simple? And you kind of like, we're going to talk a little bit about your tips for getting into the sympathetic state. And maybe that'll kind of explain some of this, but how do you work with somebody that is just super hyper emotional and can't calm themselves down enough to turn that logical brain back on?
I use the analogy for you. It's a great question. I get it every day.
Right.
There's four corners to a building. Mm-hmm. You are convinced there's only one corner, but we know there's three others.
Okay.
What are some other options?
Mm-hmm.
And when you start thinking that way, it gets you out of the primal brain or the lizard brain into the frontal lobe, your best self.
You start thinking more constructively instead of destructive. Right. I love that. That's really cool.
Yeah. I always say, what's the four corners? And no one can argue that because we know there's four, you know, but with anxiety and stress, we think that's the only corner, the one we're in. There's no other options, but there are.
Instead of thinking why, it shifts you into how do I get out?
Yes.
Yeah.
How do I get out? And different perspectives.
Right.
You know, it turns it down, right? It turns it down. So you can start thinking options.
Right. I love that. And just to sort of snowball off of that, let's talk about that. You have some videos on your website, which are really cool. Like, we know that there's infinite research on meditation now in terms of like productivity and mental health resolutions. It's like the list goes on and on.
Yes.
There's indisputable evidence that it's doing us as a whole. Right. But it's easier said than done. And for some people that really struggle with that maybe it's a high baseline of, you know, anxiety or whatever, they really struggle to find that parasympathetic stimulus. So talk us through some of those tips that you have for those people that do struggle to get from that chronic sympathetic state down into unwinding a little bit.
Part of it is that get back to the narrative, Craig. Like, what's, you know, I have a client, he's 99% sure he's got enough units to graduate from college, but he's not sure, so he's taking three extra classes.
Right.
He's absolutely maxed out. And part of it brings us down is realizing what is it you're trying to cover? What's the end goal?
Mm-hmm.
And many people can't get there, but I see, you know, I'll walk around the block with my clients. You know, I'm out here in Los Angeles, so it's not snowing. So it's a little more, you know, a little more amenable to walking.
Yeah. Definitely an option here in Canada right now.
Yeah, exactly. But that's why I say that. I find trying to get us back to a place of relaxation is realizing that your life is bigger than this event.
Yeah.
Perspective is invaluable.
Right.
And that's where I really work with people, because you can take that with you anywhere. Keeping perspective.
For sure. And it's really just finding any kind of stimulus to make you feel in the present moment is kind of like how I see it, right? Like focusing on the stimuli around you, like living, experience everything fully so that everything that's happened before that you're worrying about in the future doesn't exist. And all you've got to worry about is your breath. Obviously easier said than done, but I love that. I love that. And I love that you're walking around the block. We just saw, what is that movie? It's, did you watch the series with Paul Rudd and Will Ferrell? The Shrink Next Door.
No, I haven't.
Super cool story. It's based on a real story. And he actually does that in the, he crosses some lines in that therapist relationship, but it reminded me of that. It's anyways, I'm sidebar here, great. But
you know, listen, people are really anxious. I do a lot of guided imagery. Used to call it hypnosis guided imagery.
Yeah.
And I find people say, I can't be hypnotized. I can't do it. Do you go to sleep at night? Yes. Then you can do it.
Right.
And then you can do it. But it's about control. Part of this grief is letting go of control, but the world's not going to end if I'm not holding it.
Right.
So true. White knuckling it.
It's such a simple concept, but it's crazy how complicated it is for us to like actually live it. Right. It's so much easier said than done. So let's talk a little about emotional harmony. And that's like, I don't know if that's a technical term. It's just what I've.
No, it's a great term. I like it.
So, and how I judge my own personal happiness as a whole is how much hormonal balance I am, or emotional balance I am, in terms of like how often am I feeling anger or stress or, you know, happiness, joy, that whole thing. Cause we have to feel it all, but we can feel, if we feel too much of some stuff, it throws us out of whack. So how do you sort of talk someone into finding that right balance, or even deciding how, if they are out of balance and talking them back into it?
Two points, Craig, I go with one, curiosity versus judgment.
Right.
Not to judge your emotion, but be curious what's going on.
Right. Just observing it.
Exactly. Curiosity versus judgment. And I find even with young adults, they don't fight that. The millennials hear that, you know, okay, I'm being judgmental. Well, you're calling that bad. Is it bad? Or is it a warning light for you? The other piece of it is think about responding, not reacting.
Right.
Because if you can respond to a situation, you're pretty balanced.
You're in control. It's your logical brain making those decisions. It's not the it's not the emotion making the decisions.
Exactly. You can factor in, but when you and I are reacting, that's not our best self.
100%
Emotionally. It's not our best self.
And my partner will attest to that. It's
So exactly. We're not, I'm not voting on that one.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fair enough. So basically the common thread I'm hearing is let's find some means to be present. Accept the emotion, but let your conscious brain take control of and be in control of what you can be control of. Is that more or less?
That's right on. Yes. And I also talk about your best self.
Right.
I have clients that go, I wasn't my best self yesterday. Okay. What'd you do? Like, that would happen. Because they realize their best self is being present.
Right. Yeah.
100%. And they're scared. So, you know, we all have it, all roads lead back to the moment. But I had to keep coming this. I wasn't my best self. And he told me what he did. I'm like, okay, that was not your best self. That's a fair statement. I think he told somebody to, you know, go to hell in a handbasket. And there we go.
Yeah.
You know, true. It's not his best self. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that really helps people.
Yeah. 100%. And sort of snowballing on that a little bit. When we have these people that are hyper emotional and we talk about relationships, you can talk about the father role, the mother role and all that stuff. And there's like, I mean, we could stereotype people for the most part. I feel like hormonally there's differences, obviously the genetically predisposes to certain emotional spectrum, let's say. And that I think is in the male role and typically, and I'm overgeneralizing, but I feel like it's harder sometimes to be that emotionally available to someone that is, feels more of the spectrum, I think. So when you're talking like through a relationship like that, how do you find that common ground? How do you like when someone is like just feeling something and no matter what you say with your logic, it's just not connecting to their emotion? How do you structure that conversation, or how do you coach someone through finding that structure in that conversation to find that common ground?
You know, that happens in couples therapy 95% of the time, but maybe 99.
Yeah.
Craig, first of all, when someone's emotionally upset, I use the word emotionally intoxicated.
Right.
Like you can't reason with someone when they're drunk. Wait till they're sober.
Exactly.
And many times I with one person being very emotionally charged, and the other person doesn't know what to do, is talk about it ahead of time. What is it you would like from me?
Yeah.
And more times than not, it's just someone to hear you, not fix it. I tell guys, when in doubt, do not fix it.
Yeah.
When in doubt, do not. Okay. Unless you're asked to listen, there's been studies done that listening in itself is curative.
Yeah.
And that contains the person that feels out of control.
Right. So it's almost like the light that goes off for me is like motivational interviewing. Like you're almost helping them figure it out for themselves. Just let them talk, you know, be non-judgmental in your responses, that kind of stuff.
And I'm going to say neutral.
Neutral. Right. So
neutral.
Yeah. So, and in my own experience, I'm hearing that she wants me to meet her emotionally, which I don't know if that's the real solution there either. I mean, I don't know. Let's not turn this into a let's fix Craig's emotional relationship chat.
But a lot of guys wonder, she wants me. And if you're listening, she feels your presence.
Right.
So you're already there.
That's the stimulus that we need, right?
Bingo.
Yeah, fair enough.
If someone's listening, you know they're looking at your phone, not looking at their phone, but they're tracking you. You're feeling heard.
Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And that is the power. That is 90% the most powerful thing you can do.
Do you kind of coach people through like echoing back statements and that kind of stuff? I've heard that used as a good strategy, like sort of paraphrasing their concerns.
I find that sometimes very robotic.
Right.
Very robotic. If you're listening, you can summarize it for them.
Right.
I find that to be better. More productive.
Okay. That makes sense.
Because they know what they just said.
Yeah.
But they may not understand the totality of it.
Right.
You know, and asking questions is never, explain to me what's happening here? Why does that happen?
Mm-hmm.
Being curious, not trying to fix it.
Yeah. I love that. That's golden advice. That's probably worth the chat.
Just like I said, Craig, you just said about how our partners talk, we don't meet them emotionally. I say to guys, listen, genuinely listen.
Yeah. Yeah.
Turn the TV off. Genuinely. Because that's a lot of work.
Set your phone down. Yeah. Turn off the electronics, notification, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Just be present. I love that. Very cool.
And you wiped out 90% of the problem.
True enough. I would like to take away your whole client base. Everybody just figured that out. Yeah. All right. Let's talk about, we are in a pandemic. I don't know how the state is in California. You know, I guess it's been similar to in Canada. There's been lockdowns in and out. Yeah. So it's been tough. We can't get the gyms the way we'd normally want to. We've just been throwing a curveball and we're all kind of managing our own stress a little differently and with our fitness and health kind of stuff. So talk us through your personal health and fitness priorities at the moment and what your sort of habits look like around those priorities.
Oh yeah. You know, when the gyms were closed down here in Los Angeles, now right now, everything's open. Go figure.
Yeah. We just opened up this week, actually.
That's fantastic.
Yeah.
What I did was, whatever you can do something.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I found. People feel like they had to just reinvent their ability to work out.
Right.
Whether it be walking, running, walking hills, doing pushups, there's something everyone could do.
Yeah. 100%.
And I found that to be really the key for fitness during this. I had people either gain weight or lose weight.
Mm.
It was either one, not in between.
Yeah, it's true. Somehow you're coming back a different person. The other
right.
Side.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the other thing is with the working out, you can do it. It may not be as what we thought is productive, but it's still you're in your body. You're using your body. And when you're doing that, good things happen.
Right. It just can like, just not, it's just so much about momentum, right? It's just like stopping a dead stop. It's just twice as hard to start back up. So you just got to keep going. There's no, you're not going to love every single workout. You got to find some way to stay active. Cause you would know as well, it's just for the mental piece as much as anything. And that's the one thing we've heard, like as running a gym is that people are struggling just for that outlet for their own mental stress, as much as, you know, the maybe they're not eating super healthy or working out as much, but like the mental health really does start to suffer. And I feel like we're hitting a mental health pandemic more than anything right now.
So out here we get 220 days. No, it's more than that. 320 days of sunshine.
Oh, man.
That's unbelievable.
That sounds like a dream.
Oh my God. Right. So I feel like out here we're a little bit spoiled because you go outside and go, you know, what I tell people that are not in sun, you can do something out there, get a sun lamp, different things to help offset that lack of vitamin D or, you know, what's going on chemically.
The winter blues are a real thing here.
Yeah. Seasonal. Yeah.
Which is fantastic. God. Yeah. Cool. Awesome. Well, Stephen, this has been an awesome chat. I really appreciate your time. We're going to put a link to your website. If you're in the Los Angeles area, please do look him up. He's done great work and he's read some great books. Feel free to check out his books. What's the best means for people to follow your content, Stephen?
You know, my website, stephenpolter.com.
Okay.
And yeah, with the barbershop group, men's barbershop group is there. Great. And everything, you know, I try to keep it up to date.
Awesome. Well, we'll link to that in the show notes. All right, guys. Thanks for tuning in to this edition of Healthspan Academy, and we'll see you next time.